You're listening to a Rhino.com podcast. Yes, you are.
What's the first record you ever bought? Hey, it's Bob Lefsetz on the weekly Rhino Cast. This really is not a podcast about Little Eva, but I was reminded of Little Eva because Little Eva was the first record I needed to buy. I don't really think I bought it with my own money. Let me be clear about this, okay? We had a lot of music in my house. We had one of those big Columbia stereos. Remember with the, you know, we had a satellite speaker and another one you could plug in. Actually, when I started playing electric guitar, because we all played electric guitar after the Beatles hit, I remember taking one of the satellite speakers and plugging it directly to my guitar and shorting out the whole house. The concept of needing an amplifier never really occurred to me. Well, you know, go directly from the guitar to the speaker. That's how you learn your lessons. At least I didn't electrocute myself. My mother used to play the show tunes, and my mother had an infatuation with certain hits of the day. She bought us Purple People Eater. She bought Big Girls Don't Cry. And I bought cartoon records. I remember Rough and Ready. Big cartoon characters, love them. I would buy the LPs of that, okay? But in 1962, I had to buy The Locomotion. I still remember it had a blue label. Why did I need to buy it? I don't really know. I really got into baseball. And this was around the same time as transistors. My father would always buy these off brands. You hear about Sony and the transistor. We never had a Sony transistor. We would go to Barker's on the Post Road in Westport, and we would buy, you know, some crappy little knockoff. I think I said this before. One time my father said, oh, they're selling them, you know, for $7.99. And he bought one. We got it, you know, in the car. It didn't work. So he went back, got the demo, because they tuned the demo so the demo actually worked. And you used to have them under your pillow listening to the baseball game. You used to have these 9-volt batteries. You'd touch them to your tongue, see if there's any life in the battery. And I guess I kind of drifted from the baseball games to the music stations. And in Connecticut, where I grew up, you listened to New York radio, except for the local station in case there was a snow day. You want to find out there was no snow. But what were the call letters of that? All of a sudden, I can't remember. Call letters of the local WICC. That was in Fairfield, Connecticut. And I remember in the Cub Scouts, they took us there, and all the commercials were on a giant red disc. It was enormous. I remember I bumped into it, and it skipped the commercials, and the DJ was talking to us. And after the record went, it was finished, he went to play the commercials. Oh, wrong commercial. And WICC would go from news to talk to music, but it was really the New York stations. There were really three on AM, WMCA, WABC, and 1010 Winds. The real hip people listened to 1010 Winds, which went talk, left the music game first. I was big into Cousin Brucey. Before Cousin Brucey, it was Dan Ingram, and after Cousin Brucey, it would be Scott Muni. Number one in the nation, the Scott Muni Show. But I love Cousin. And every Tuesday they had the countdown. And I must have shifted my radio. I became really hooked on the music. And I heard The Locomotion. I needed to own it. I don't think I paid. I might have paid for it with my own money. But, you can't drive at that age. I made my mother take me to the store where I bought it. And the funny thing about the record, and Lord only knows how this happened, because it couldn't be because I couldn't have been me because I take such good care of my shit, was the record got a crack in it. But it was one of those cracks, records are a circle where you can put it together. You can still play it. And I'd play it on this little pink stereo my father bought in some kind of closeout sale. Which, you didn't take your stereos anywhere, but people would come over, you had a pink stereo. So if I did, I had a blotter in the corner with one of those gooseneck lamps, or then after that was a tensor lamp. I remember the high-intensity lamps, remember those? That was the thing. My mom said, oh, you want a high-intensity lamp, but it doesn't give me enough light to do my homework. And I had my blotter, on the side of my blotter, I would leave the transistor. When you would hear, news flashes, I think I told you about hearing Martin Luther King in 1968 getting assassinated while I'm doing my math homework. And you go announce it to the house and everybody's kind of caught off guard. And how would you know? But I got turned on to the locomotion. I was in fifth grade. I'd gone from third to fifth. I skipped fourth grade. And you had to get all new friends. And was that why I was into the record? Locomotion, I don't know. Now, the first friend I developed, who I've heard, the miracle of the internet year for these people, was Keith Batchelder. And I remember going to his house, bringing my Locomotion record. And they had what was called radiant heat, whereas the heat came up from the floor. And you could lie on the floor. It was so warm. But the second record I had to have was the Monster Mash.
For my monster from his slab began to rise, and suddenly, to my surprise,
he did the mash.
He did the monster mash.
The monster mash.
It was a graveyard smash.
He did the mash.
It caught on in a flash.
He did the mash.
He did the monster mash.
Now, I'm at my girlfriend's house, and Lord only knows why, you know, you're reminiscing. That's what we Alta Cockers do. And she said, oh, she loved the Monster Mash. This is just, you know, 10 days ago. She loved the Monster Mash. She had a whole thing. And she said, I still have my Monster record. And she went through all her vinyl records. She pulled out this record. It was all Monster tunes. And she's reminiscing about playing these songs again and again. We're having a laugh and good time, remembering the old days of the 60s. And the very next day, I have to go to the East Coast to do a gig. I'm in the Poconos. And although I can't get any email on my BlackBerry, each room has Wi-Fi, and I got my computer, and my home page is the Yahoo News, and I see that Bobby Boris Pickett dies, and it jets me right back.
From my laboratory in the castle east, to the master bedroom where the vampires feast, the ghouls all came from their humble abode to get a jolt from my electrode.
They did the mash.
They did the monster mash.
The monster mash.
It was a graveyard smash.
They did the mash.
It caught on in a flash.
They did the mash.
They did the monster mash. The zombies were having fun.
In a shoebox.
The party had just begun.
In a shoebox.
The guests included Wolfman,
in a shoebox.
Dracula, and his son.
This was pre-Beatles in America. You know, the Beatles were starting to hit overseas, really 63, more than 62. But we had no idea who the Beatles were. And this was just coming off of the Phil Spector was hot, but they had the mashed potato. They had all these dance crazes. And so that's why it's a mash. And they had those girl backup singers going, do whoop, whatever, blah, blah, blah. Now, I'm in this hotel room, and I'm playing this record because I have such fond memories. And I realize it's got nothing to do with the lyrics. The lyrics are great, but it's a great groove. Okay, you know, we have these hip-hop tracks and they say, oh, you know, there's the hook. If you listen to the song and they add that little change here, you know, the zombies, you know, with the bridge, the zombies were having fun. And then he goes, Dracula and his son. They get back into it. You're moving your body when you're listening to this song.
Rocky all were digging the sounds. Igor on chains, back by his baying hounds. The coffin bangers were about to arrive with their vocal group, the Crypt Kicker Five.
They played the mash.
They played the monster mash.
The monster mash.
It was a graveyard smash.
They played the mash.
It caught on in a flash.
They played the mash.
They played the monster.
Okay, so you can look it up because this is the net. Okay, Bobby Boris Pickett is just a guy playing gigs, and he does a Boris Karloff imitation from like a young age. And they come up with this number, which no one wants to put out, and this guy Paxton puts it out. Now, the way the bubbles are, he put a straw into a glass and blew the bubbles. And they have this novelty track, which the guy lives the rest of his life. People have even written songs. This guy had a can of wrote a song about that Bobby Boris Pickett had a one-hit wonder. And I write about this record and all that it means to me, and it's amazing what you find out. The guy was because he recently died, of course, he was the starter at the golf course like a couple hundred yards from my house. It's a public course called Penmar, right on Rose. Most people consider it Venice. It's Mar Vista. It might even still be Santa Monica at that particular point in time. It's one of those executive courses, so it's not quite as long as a regular nine-hole course. But some of the holes are like 300 yards, and that's where I got my hole-in-one. Just so you know, a hole-in-one is a lucky shot. But I was playing with a friend who got me back into it. I played a lot when I was a kid. And then in the 80s, this guy got back into it and took it oh so seriously. But I had natural ability. And when you play the public courses, they're all backed up. And the nature of a par three is you have to wait for the people to get off the green. So you got the people who just get off the green. We are on the tee with a foursome. There's another tee, another set of people waiting on our tee. There's another set of people who just finished the hole before us, and there are people on the green. I stand up with a 7-iron. I hit a beautiful golf shot. It goes up, and there's a draw. The green is tilted towards us. The ball lands about 10 or 12 feet from the pin and goes right in. And all hell breaks loose at the golf course. It's like I got a smile on my face. This is fantastic. Because you can hit a shitty shot and have it go in the hole. It's a beautiful shot, and everybody's freaking out. My fucked up friend that I'm playing with, well, I'm not really sure. Went in. I mean, it's not like the green is way up in the air. It's facing us. Of course it went in. We got to see. We got to see if it's really in the hole. I would say that's the last time I played golf, but actually I played once more. It's like, come on. I mean, yeah, it's like, you know, when you feel jealous of me that I got a hole in one. Granted, it was a good shot, but it's not like you could aim to get a hole in one. People play their whole lives and never have a hole in one. But it turned, so I stopped playing when Bobby Boris Pickett was the starter. And I heard from all these people. They say, well, these guys used to work at Atlantic Records there. And, you know, so they Bobby Boris Pickett, he's got no chip on his shoulder. He says, oh, so how's Ahmet? It's just wild hearing all the stories. So it was originally hit in 62, hit again in 73. He tried to follow it up with a track, which, of course, even the tracks he did make it, we know because of Top 40 Radio, Monster's Holiday. But really, it was about this one song, The Monster Mash.
From his coffin, Black's voice did ring. Seemed he was troubled by just one thing. Opened the lid and shook his fist and said, whatever happened to my Transylvania twist?
It's now the mash.
It's now the monster mash.
The monster mash.
I got to stop here. This is why these records are so great. You know, it was done almost instantaneously. And therefore, all the magic was not squeezed out. When he does, you know, whatever happened to my Transylvania twist, just the accent alone is hysterical. But the fact they came up with Transylvania twist, it wasn't like they waited for weeks. Well, what's the exact name that we should come up with? Don't forget, there was a peppermint twist, Transylvania twist. And then you got the girls singing the exact same way they've been singing the whole song. It's now the mash. It's now the monster. It's so stupid that it's perfect.
And it's a graveyard smash.
It's now the mash.
It's caught on and it's loud.
It's now the mash.
It's now the monster mash.
Now, as I say, it's like a whole story here. Now we're getting the resolution.
Everything's cool, Drax's a part of the band. And my monster mash is the hit of the land. For you, the living, this mash was meant to. When you get to my door, tell them what it said.
Then you can mash.
Then you can monster mash.
The monster mash.
And do my graveyard smash.
Then you can mash.
You'll catch on in a flash.
Then you can mash.
Then you can monster mash.
Mash.
It's pure greatness, right down to the end with the monsters. What I love about this song is, I say, it's pure inspiration. It's done on a lark. It's unfiltered. That's why it's so great. The calculated productions of Mariah Carey will be outlived by this one novelty track from, at this point, 45 years ago. That's what creativity is, feeling something and laying it down. The best stuff I do when I write is just I get an idea, I just lay my fingers down, and I don't change it because once you contemplate it, you fuck it up. Okay, so this guy did this one song and lived the rest of his life because he was touring and doing other things all in between being a starter at the golf course, and it worked for him. It was a one-hit wonder, but he didn't feel bad about it, and his mark will last longer than all these people you've seen on your TV who've completely forgotten because the material sucked. So the lines from this song, you know, as soon as I heard he died, I could just say, tell them Boris sent you. I just know. I mean, I stared at that record so many times. Bobby Boris Pickett. When you see something like that and you're 10 years old, you know, you don't see it with the same humor as an adult. Like other people are calling it Boris. It's almost like this is his name, Bobby Boris Pickett. And these memories are ingrained into us. They're part of our life. Monster Mash is part of me as much as playing baseball after school, which I love to do. So I know you haven't forgotten it either. I know that you listen to it every Halloween, you get a smile on your face. And until next time, it's Bob Lefsetz for the RhinoCast.
Hey, everybody, what's happening? You're here with another edition of Records. Oh, it's a beautiful day.
It's
to talk about records.
It's got to be a new day.
It's a new day.
We got to let a man come in and do the popcorn, like James Brown.
Everybody, I'm Mac. I've been doing this record show for a couple episodes here, and it's really fun and wonderful. And I have my compatriot Chris here. You remember him from the last one we did with Witchfinder General. And we have our new guest here, Michelle.
Hello.
Hey, yeah. And we're going to talk about today a rhythm and blues singer by the name of Betty Levette, who is possibly one of the greatest talents I've ever heard, but has kind of been a little bit of an underground secret since probably the 60s. And she has a record out that we reissued on Rhino. We're actually going to talk about a Rhino record at this point, amazingly enough. And it's called Child of the 70s, and it was originally recorded in 1972 on Atlantic subsidiary ATCO, and it was then shelved before it ever came out, so it's remained a secret. In fact, it was thought for a long time that the master tapes were lost in the Atlantic warehouse fire in the 70s. I can't tell you any more about that. That was a line I read somewhere, so I'm just going to take it as gospel. But I like it. It gives it intrigue, and that's one thing we strive for here at Records is intrigue. And occasionally we try and be factual, so I'm going to hand it over to Chris here for a minute. Chris, tell me about Betty Levette a little bit.
Well, you know, it's ironic. I was just looking at the liner notes, and she recorded at Bollock Sounds, which is like Turner's thing. And that version, It Ain't Easy, I was like, when it came on, I was just like, you know, wow, this sounds like Tina Turner, man.
I was getting that, too. I saw her stuff on YouTube, a lot of Tina Turner in there.
Did she look like Tina Turner in the stuff you saw on YouTube?
No, she looked more Supreme-ish in the early days.
Yeah, she looks Supreme-ish. If you look at the album artwork on there, yeah, it's got that vibe.
Well, she played with Motown. I mean, yeah. Not played with on Motown, but she kind of like interacted with Motown.
They wanted to use her as Diana Ross's replacement, apparently.
Really?
That's what I read, yeah.
Ooh, dropping some knowledge. That's good.
I don't know what happened there.
Wow. Yeah, well, you know, she worked with all the right people over her career. That's definitely true. And the weird thing about it, you know, if you listen to, like, I was noticing just listening to Soul Tambourine, mm-hmm. that it has like this ragtime feel,
mm-hmm.
which was popular in the 70s with Tony Orlando and Dawn.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
That yellow ribbon.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and she seems to hit. The weird thing about Betty Levette is she seems to hit on every different facet of music.
Right.
Kind of like throwing everything against the wall, all these ideas, and seeing if they stick.
Well, it's kind of almost the definition of a pop singer.
Exactly.
And there's the irony that this is basically a pop singer who is now starting to be appreciated 30 years after, you know, she started, who was, you know, now if somebody were to do that and do everything, it would be called taking chances. But back then that was called trying to be a pop entertainer.
Well,
you know,
Christina Aguilera does stuff like that.
She does.
You know,
she does now. Yeah, in the beginning that was pretty much straight hit making stuff. But
oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm sure Betty Levette's early days were probably similar, too. But it's really weird. I'm, like, looking at this now, and it never dawned on me till just now that, like, she went the gamut.
Yeah.
Of, I mean, all the black and white children. So she was, like, social.
Yeah.
Politically conscious.
Absolutely.
Disco track, too.
Yeah, she did the disco stuff. She was covering a lot of really good classic rock songs.
Yep.
Which weren't hits, like, you know, The Stealer by Free.
Yeah.
That's not like necessarily a hit.
Right.
You might hear it on KLOS.
Right.
You know, but really they're just going to play All Right Now. You know what I mean?
Well, it's interesting, too, how she, you know, I've been trying to get some sense of how she chose her songs or who chose her songs, but I was reading this interview with her and she was saying that when she did, she's been doing some records recently on the Anti label, a subsidiary of Epitaph, and she was talking about how in her last record, she had people bringing her all these songs, you know, the guys who were making the records with her, she rejected like 40 or 50 songs, and they were getting very frustrated and going, oh, you know, what do we got to do here? And she basically said, like, look, you know, it's very hard for someone to pick songs for somebody else, especially someone who's older than them and has been through life a little bit more. And she's like, that's somebody, you know, like, bringing a man in and saying, okay, you got to go to bed with this man now. You know, like,
right.
it's that level of commitment and intimacy when you're picking a song, what you're going to do with it. And that said a lot to me about her commitment to it, but I still didn't get a sense of why did you, what did you hear the Steeler? What is it? Why did you do It Ain't Easy? Why did, you know, for any number of songs that you've covered.
Oh, yeah. Heart of Gold.
Yeah.
Neil Young. I saw another interview with her on YouTube, like a backstage interview right before, a couple hours ago. Mm-hmm. And basically, I don't know if she had a manager or a producer basically tell her in the 60s, you have to be able to sing everything to be a good singer.
Yeah, that was her her
Jim
manager.
Lewis, I think his name
was. Yeah. And, yeah, he was kind of like a mentor of hers for about, 15 years. Yeah. And that's kind of something she alluded to and said, he was somebody who just really put that home that you have to be an entertainer first. Don't worry about all these pop dalliances trying to hit here and hit there and do that. Yeah. You just got to be good whether you got a record out or not.
Yeah,
so
sing everything you can.
Yeah, absolutely.
See, it's kind of like American Idol. It does that.
Right.
That's like one of the only good things about American Idol is they put you through the ringer.
Yep.
So you're like, you got to sing country, you got to sing jazz, you got to do all these things. You know, most of these people, these contestants, they still probably have no idea even what they're doing.
Oh, no, absolutely. And that's the one thing where I think the nice thing about American Idol is it doesn't lie to you. It doesn't pretend to be anything else other than it is. You're going to and be a complete pop singer.
Right.
And it's you always know from sort of the game show side of it that you see somebody who, shows some promise in like the early rounds. And you go, they're going to get killed when they get to Motown Week. Or they're going to get killed when they get to Country Week.
Country
they ain't going to do it.
Country Week is a doozy.
Oh, absolutely. Especially now where it's funny to also look at a time like this. Mm-hmm. When you hear something like It Ain't Easy, it's got a very southern country, feel, and this was prevalent in soul a lot. Ray Charles sort of pioneered it doing the country and western songs he did at the time. And you have those two things getting married together very close. Like people were seeing the opposite in each other and going like, ooh, I see the soul in country and I see the country in soul. And now, you're back to a point where those things have diverged so much because of, the way the marketing and where the money is, and you have to hit your group. Mm-hmm. You can't just sort of throw it out and try and catch everybody. You're not going to catch everybody anymore. So when somebody's faced with, growing up as a country singer and having to sing soul, good luck. And vice versa.
Right, right.
Whereas then, because no one's accentuated the middle ground between those two that does exist.
Yeah, the weird thing about the fact that she runs the gamut, I wonder if she's really a true fan of all this stuff. Because you said earlier, she's sleeping with a guy is equivalent to like covering a song.
Right.
So you wonder, like you just said, like, was she a big fan of Neil Young? Did she like the first edition?
She's, and it's funny that she should bring that up because there is a line at the end of that interview referenced earlier where they ask, because they're asking her about Amy Winehouse, because being a soul singer du jour, and they're saying, have you listened to her? Like, I've heard of her, but I don't really I don't spend my time listening to other people. They should be listening to me, sort of thing. Like, it's like, yeah. Okay, I think you've earned that statement.
A lot of true artists feel like that, though.
Yeah.
Like, James Brown, he could care less about what he did, and he didn't care about people sampling his stuff. He thought, why would you go and do that?
Mm-hmm.
Like, go make new music.
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely.
You know, it's amazing to me. Man, I can't think of how many people I've met, and I've been like, so you must have been into, us talking to Don Bowles, and I'm like, oh, you're a hardcore drummer from the early 80s. What do you think of the Bad Brains, man? Like, you probably got, all I know is they wouldn't share their weed with me. That was his only story, and he was just not impressed with any of his contemporaries at the time, because Neil Smith from Alice Cooper,
mm-hmm.
What did he say? You know what he said?
What?
No gods before me.
Oh, no gods before me. That's the truth,
but
I believe it.
That's what I asked him when I talked to him. I was like, hey, man, you must have been were you hanging out with Mark Bolan and Slade and Sweet and all that. And he's like, nope, didn't know anything that was going on. I listened to Buddy Rich. That's what he said.
No, it's true, and it's the same thing. When you hear someone like George Harrison talk, and all he'd want to talk about is Roy Orbison and Buddy Holly,
right?
And cats like that. At the most, Ravi Shankar. That was his sort of like current pop infatuation. As it were. But I, and we talked about that before, that no gods before me statement, where, when you start trying to do any sort of artistic endeavor on your own, and you're committed to it in any fashion, I think you just find that you suddenly those things aren't as important to you anymore. Like you know, being at the behest of your idols,
right.
Suddenly the playing field just equalizes, even if it doesn't really. You know, even if you're not, you know, A, as accomplished or B, as famous or any number of things, it doesn't matter. You just go like, oh, I'm in this club now.
Yeah, that's so, exactly the point.
Yeah, I'm not waiting outside with an autograph any book anymore, you know. And that's a drag to some degree because, you know, it's a totally a lot of fun to you know, fan out on things like that. But I can definitely see someone taking that attitude through a 30-year career of ups and downs like Betty LaVette and being able to go, you know what, I'll catch up to it eventually, but, you know, you guys should really cock an ear this way, you know?
Yeah, it seems like she was just, you know, her thing. That's what she did for a living.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Just like anybody, hey, I manage a McDonald's. That's my job.
That's what she said, too. She's like, I'm a singer, but I'm a mother, I'm a grandmother, I'm all these, you know, this
oh,
is
yeah.
who I am, this
mm-hmm.
is it.
Yep.
You
know? That's it. That's like, that's what you do. So,
yeah.
You know what I mean? Nothing wrong with that.
And she, you know, but she started out in 1962. She started out before that with a local label up in Michigan, you know, cutting some sides. But then Atlantic signed her in 62, and she had, like, her one hit, like, right out of the gate, My Man, My Lovin' Man. I think that was the title of it.
Yeah.
We'll play it a little later. And, you know, top 10 R&B hit. And then after that, she just couldn't catch a break, you know. I mean, still recording good material, still progressing in terms of, you know, the artistry as a singer. But bouncing around from independent label to independent label and eventually landing back on Atlantic in 1972 to record Child of the 70s. And speaking of that, Chris, let's play another track off of here.
Okay. You know, it's really weird. I'm looking at it. I mean, she really does the gamut. She's a fortune teller.
Yep.
She, you know, man.
And it's funny. There's a couple tracks on there where it says composer unknown.
Really?
If ain't that about, you know.
Outside woman, yeah. Souvenirs. Yeah, you're
yeah.
right.
Go and those are excellent songs, but it's like, who wrote them?
Let's bless that free cover.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, since we just were talking about it.
The Steeler.
As the CD queues up. It's not like a record player.
No, it's not.
We have one of those here. We should use
it. Oh, shit, I got to turn the thing back up.
All right.
It's number 4.
Mixmaster
Matt here.
Yeah, I'm going to tell a little secret. Hopefully Jonathan's going to fix that later. But Jonathan's not here today. We're flying without a net. No engineer. So basically I pressed the space bar and we were off and running. Now, as you can see, the air is electric.
Yeah. Electric. Boy, did you know,
very
that's...
Very tired
that's...
of my shit.
That was a totally different version of that song. Like, I remember,
yeah.
I haven't really tried to dissect that song. You know, I just listened to it, you know. I wasn't
right.
trying to be like, hey, like, really pay attention, buddy. That was the horn sections
mm-hmm.
and the wah-wah guitar going on. That is nothing like the original version. And she really funked it up, man.
True.
I saw her do a Dolly Parton song on that Letterman clip, and it was a Dolly Parton song.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Which
Little
one?
Little Sparrow.
Oh, okay. Right on.
Sounded nothing like Dolly Parton.
Was it funky?
Completely.
Really?
Well, the thing is she, you know, you can tell just by, you know, A, hearing the songs, but then B, you know, any little bit you hear her talk is this is somebody who, I mean, just, you know, put this in perspective, how many possessors of this level of talent have been rewarded, you know, at least somewhat consistently over their career, whether it be with more work, more opportunities. You know, they may not have gotten rich, but everybody knows who they are. And this is somebody who kept going for 30 years and would say, and we were talking about it earlier, where she'd say the only thing to do in like the fallow periods between her hits, and those periods would stretch in terms of the charts for a few years. I mean, she'd stay busy doing Broadway or, you know, cutting some disco every now and again before the, when that was
sounds
hitting.
Sounds like doing cocaine. Or I cut some disco every now and again, man.
No, that's all right. That's it. We've come up with a new term. That'll be our
I'm going to call you on the phone. I'm like, what you doing, Cat Daddy?
I'm cutting
some disco, Cat Daddy. You know what I'm saying? Keeping it real. Yeah, you better mix that in with a little bit of country. Because that disco, if you just mainline disco, you're going down, man.
Oh, no, the beat's going to get you.
Yeah, oh, Jesus.
But, you know, she was somebody who, she said, they said, well, what did you do all that time? She said, you know, I lived my life, but basically sitting there waiting for that phone to ring, because every now and again it would ring. And that, you know, that must be an interesting existence, knowing that you got what it takes. And she said, the only thing I do is go to the gym. I'm going to go to the gym. Right. I'm going to make sure when the time comes that I am ready to go and I'm looking fabulous because I know I can sing. I just want to make sure. And that's, she said, this interview that I was reading, whether she did it, she's 61 years old now. And she says, I'm 61, I still got my pipes, and I can still fit into a size 6. Right. And it's like, God bless you, baby.
Yeah, sure. She said, too. I mean, she's like, you got to work at having my voice because she's singing so hard.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
You know, so she said she was more like Wilson Pickett than Dionne Warwick.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
So she does. She's like, I got to exercise, you know, my back muscles and my abs. I got to, you know, all the time because I'm pushing so hard when I sing.
Oh, it's true. You know, you got that diaphragm working overtime.
Yeah.
And, you know, she recorded the Child of the 70s at Muscle Shoals. And she used to, you know.
It sounds like it, though, because you can hear the horns, and it's got this soulful groove to it.
And it's very, and it's interesting.
Not Northern Soul at all.
Well, that's the point, because the, you know, they talk about the fact that she was part of that generation of Northern Soul singers who came south to record. Wilson Pickett, Aretha Franklin.
Otis.
And you know, Betty LeVette. Coming down, they say, like, you know, it's interesting to note how these Northern singers can come down and just fit so easily into the Southern Muscle Shoals sort of sound. Right. And she basically said, like, well, you know, we were the first generation to live up there. So it wasn't like the South was a foreign land to us. You know, right. It was like we were the first generation of people to actually be born in the North. So we were familiar with the South. And it's just like coming home. And, you know, she's, you know, I don't know what to say. There it is. Pawn to that.
Let me bust the tambourine.
Oh, yeah.
Let's go to it.
Now, set this up for a sec, because we're going to listen to Soul Tambourine, and there's a sample in here, you said. Well, something was used as a sample, right?
Well, we'll play it, and when it gets to the break, we'll stop it, and we'll talk about it.
Oh, okay. So you've got a plan.
I got a plan, Stan. That's the shit right there.
That was a smooth fade out. Did you dig that?
This was heavily sampled in the late 80s by like guys like Diamond D and the whole Digging in the Crates crew.
That ba-dum, bom, ba-dum, bom,
yeah, Marley Marl. Like, that was just, you know, it was a New York break beat. they picked up on it. You know, one more thing before we get into this part of the conversation. I noticed she doesn't have a specifically unique voice. She's kind of across, you know, we were talking about American Idol and all that
stuff.
Right. She's very, she's not Marva Whitney, you know, or one of like James Brown's girls. When you hear those people, you're like, oh, Lynn Collins, that's Lynn Collins, or Tina Turner or whatever.
Right.
But like an American Idol contestant, she's super competent at what she does. You can't take, like, you know, Kelly Clarkson, you can talk all you want about her, but she's real good at being an idol.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
She's the best one, actually.
Yeah, she's got all the bases covered. And the Betty LeVette, like you keep saying about, like, I'm ready to go, you know, I wait for the phone to ring for 30 years.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly what she is. She's competent at what she does, and it's not mind-blowing, it's not world-stopping, but it's just damn good, and the quality's there.
It took her 30 years to be mind-blowing, you know, good at what she does, too.
Yeah, well, it's constantly going up the mountain. Right. It's going to the mountain.
Yeah, you know, that's a good thing, though. Yeah. Like, people don't, like, that might be it, you know, the fact that she's always struggling.
Well, yeah, I look at it sometimes like someone like Andre Williams, you know.
Uh-huh.
Like, here's a guy that I remember, you know, coming to prominence in my mind, and this is when I wasn't following soul at all, but in the 90s, when he was started cutting all those records and playing with the Flash Express around L.A. here and stuff like that. And this was a guy who had his career in the late 50s and early 60s, you know, with, you know, Chicken Fat and, you know, Bacon Grease and everything, Pussy Stank and everything else, you know. And it was wonderful. But, you know, he just obviously kept going, you know, he kept going, right. And there's nothing you can do. It's like carving a statue, you know. Right. Everyone's got that. If you got anything, you got that hunk of marble sitting there, and it's how pretty a statue you're going to make out of that, you know, or how good.
She kept challenging herself the whole way.
Oh, yeah.
You have to keep doing that if you're going to keep singing. I mean, if you're going to keep creating, you have to keep challenging yourself.
If there are any young singers out there or old ones, that's the truth, so listen the fuck up.
Yeah, that's true, the challenge. And you know, she's challenging herself because she never made it huge.
Right.
And that's why she'll keep working at coming up with something kick-ass, because she's like, well, I did this, that didn't work, so I'll try another thing.
Well, there are those people like Britney out of the gate.
Yeah.
Famous.
And right.
Now she cannot get a grasp on any kind of reality or what to do next. You know,
well, and it's
where the problem is.
She's actually where Betty LeVette is now, Britney Spears, because she can't. You can't keep replicating pop music. You kind of have to go back to the drawing board.
If she were smart, she'd, you know, disappear for a few years and come out with a rock record or something like that.
Like Madonna can always.
I agree. You know, I agree. You know? But I was going to say the one thing that's interesting about Britney Spears right now. Wow, I didn't see this one coming. But is that her? I've heard a couple tracks off her new record, and it's kind of they're good. They're actually good tracks. I mean, there are some tracks that you don't go, oh, this is embarrassing. You know, because you're thinking, I mean, the girl's such a mess. You think it's going to be a horror show, you know.
But maybe she's got people looking out for her now that are going to go, you know what?
No, it's all the producers.
Yeah.
It's all the producers. Like, each track says more about the producer than it does about the artist. And that's where, you know, unfortunately, Britney Spears doesn't fit into any of these conversations, really, outside of being an iconic pop figure. Because she never had the voice nor a way to translate her pain or life into anything that actually resonates.
Not yet.
Not yet.
She's pretty young. So she might come up with something in 10 years that might be fantastic.
That's true, but she also is going to have to miraculously start having an awesome voice, too. Although you'll never know because, you know, they just fix shit now.
But also, is Britney Spears really a diehard performer like Betty LeVette?
No. I think that was pretty evidenced.
No. So there
and
you
she's
go.
Not into keeping herself into shape either.
But that, yeah, exactly. So she's not going to work hard for this. Like, she's taking her money and running. You know what I mean?
Fuck yeah.
But, you know.
Or walking briskly.
Yeah.
Or driving.
Or just driving. Yeah.
Driving out of control.
If you take somebody like Madonna, too, she kept challenging herself all the way through pretty much most of her records. After a certain point, they're sort of different.
Yeah, but Madonna also had a base that she started from with the whole Jelly Bead stuff with Holiday.
Yeah. She still got a dance base, but she did kind of evolve from that.
Well, and you also have to
think. But she could always go back to that.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? She could go back to that 80s dance sound that she always had that was popular from the get-go.
But the day that she does that is the day that she becomes a nostalgia act.
Yeah,
and she may have already crossed that line. And I'm not a huge Madonna fan. There is some stuff I like. But, you know, as somebody who's, you know, kind of tying in with this, you know, with the song It Ain't Easy that David Bowie covered, which is really interesting to me that David Bowie plucked a song from a you know, that a soul singer in 1972 was doing, because this is way pre-Young Americans. You had no inkling that David Bowie was this attuned to soul music, however he heard it in the first place. Who knows, because the record never came out. I mean, somebody else must have done it too. But that being said, there was a point where David Bowie went back a couple years ago to making records like, okay, I'm going to try and make records like the Spiders from Mars again as best I can, like my classic period. And that was kind of, there it is. There's the end of the game. There's the bookends on your creative career. Right. You know, he just kept going. He embraced everything right into the 90s, right into drum and bass, stuff like that. Like every new thing that would come up, Bowie was there and would do a credible job at it. You know, even sort of quasi, you know, like Nine Inch Nails, soundscapes.
But then you got to come up with the whole thing of, you don't have to work at being good because you already are good. You know, like Chuck D on the new Public Enemy record.
Oh, yes.
He does not have to pretend to be something that's happening now. All he has to do is do what he did in 1987.
Right.
And the shit's going to fly. And that's what he did on the new record. And we all three of us know that new Public Enemy record.
Yes.
And we all say it's a good record.
It's a good record.
And the reason
go
is...
Go get it.
Yeah,
if you're
it's really good.
This.
And the reason is because he said, I don't have to change nothing. I could just do what I did. And so he basically put his mindset in a 20-year regression.
Right.
And but at the same time, he was, well, it's 2007, so I got to stay contemporary. So just because you do something that goes back to what you did before doesn't always mean that you're selling out or resting on your laurels
or not
a nostalgia thing.
Yes, it does.
No, I disagree.
You're right. I think in the case of someone...
It can be in a lot of cases, but not... You know, Metallica doing Saint Anger was them trying to be a nostalgia thing.
Right.
Because it was like them blatantly saying, we're doing all fast songs and we're going to do no guitar solos and it's going to be bam, bam, bam. Just like the first album.
Right.
But it's like, you guys are so wrong.
No, well, you can tell when someone's lost touch with reality. The first sign of that is to think that you have any inkling of who you used to be 20 years ago. I mean, that's your first mistake. To assume that you can go like, well, you know, I covered that terrain, so I can go back there. It's like, you're a different person, my friend. It's not going to come out the same.
Yeah.
It's a different world, too.
Yeah, absolutely.
When I saw James Brown a couple years ago, his band, they played all the old stuff. They didn't play anything new. Now, his live show was basically him doing what he does without worrying about what was happening.
Right.
James Brown's show that I saw 2 years ago was probably the same James Brown show that happened 20 years ago.
Right.
You know, in 1987. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
Or 85 or whatever, 2 years ago. But you know what I'm saying?
Right.
It was the same show. So, you know, maybe I think that's exactly what he did. He just kept doing what he does, which is probably another thing with Betty LeVette. She just does what she does. She's a soul singer.
Yeah.
She's
although she doesn't like the term soul. This is something I was also reading. Read up on her. She calls it rhythm and blues. And she says, soul's a term that white people put on this music.
Really?
Now, I've never heard anyone say that before.
Yeah, me neither.
But that was the first time when I went, wow, okay. She's like, you'll never hear a rhythm and blues singer refer to it as soul, unless he's trying to explain what they do to someone who doesn't speak English.
Right.
You know? So that was interesting. I'm like, wow, you are, you know, she's a maverick. You know, I love it.
No, she's astute, and that's the best thing. That's why we're doing the show about her, because she is astute, you know. So let's talk about that sample real quick.
Yeah.
The soul tambourine, man. That's a funky breakbeat, man. That's a damn funky breakbeat.
Agreed.
You know, so that's like a mark right there in a career. You know,
oh yeah.
If you can have some record that somebody else thought was dope enough that I'm gonna sample a little bit of your record,
right?
Man, that's already success in my book. I mean,
it's already success. It's true.
Yeah. And as a funky hook, not even as like sort of color or just a sound jabbing in. You know, like people will use a whole melange of things and collage of things for samples. But to know that you got a bedrock sort of breakbeat.
Oh, that's good. That is. I mean, you could rock that beat at any club. You know, just loop it.
Yeah.
You got the crowd rocking.
Oh, amen.
You're a crowd rocker that day. That's for sure. And that's the, you know, everybody probably has their opinion on sampling and whatnot. But that's, you know, once you've done that, you've kind of like passed the grade. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, you could take anything you want. Like, Isaac Hayes was this. He was a songwriter. He was a producer and arranger. He was all these things. But he also made some kick-ass breaks.
Mm-hmm.
And the best part about a break is that's what motherfuckers react to.
Yep.
You know what I'm saying? That's how hip-hop started, because yep. the DJ was going, well, I noticed everybody was getting down when that one part, that bridge of that, you know, James Brown record came on,
so
you know?
Let's keep looping it.
What was that?
Let's keep looping.
Exactly. Yep. Exactly. And so I'm pretty smitten with
but
that.
But this is also this is an interesting area to go in, because what you're also talking about is the destruction of a formal song structure that had existed up to that point. Now, it's a joyous destruction because you're discovering something new and creating a new art form. But this is something that Betty Levitt commented about when she had her one disco hit, which the name escapes me. You should take a look at that and see if you can find it. But she was saying that she didn't go for any of that disco stuff. So she had basically signed the way her rights.
Doing the best I can.
Doing the best I can. She signed her rights away to that song before it ever hit the air, before it ever blew up, because she thought disco was bullshit, because she's like, I'm not a dancer. You know, I'm not one of those, it's like, I like songs. And to me, disco was the destruction of songs, though, because it was all, again, it's you could say the same thing about hip-hop. It's sort of based around the beat, or at least at its core.
Yeah, but you can get creative with it. You can get creative with everything. Like Brian Eno said when he heard I Feel Love, you know, by Donna Summer. He walked into the studio while him and Bowie were doing, what, like Lodger or something like that. And he went, I've just heard the sound of the future.
Mm-hmm.
You know, unprecedented.
That was a standout disco track, too, of all the disco.
It was also one of the first disco tracks. It's like saying Sugar Hill Gang Rappers Delight is a standout. Well, it's also one of the first, so it's hard not to be, you know.
But nothing else sounds like that record. Even as disco progressed, nothing still sounds like that record either.
Well, Giorgio Moroder's other records.
It's true.
Too.
And it's also kind of psychedelic in a way. Like, I can see, like, that's a very spacey sort of track where disco, as it evolved, just got more and more normal. It's just like everything else, you know?
It just got more normal.
Well, that record was
Make sure you got A, B, and C.
Right.
If you got A, B, and C, you've got the record, whereas that had D, E, and F in it, too.
Right.
You know?
And that was obviously influenced by things like George Moroder. He's an Italian dude, so he was European. He was obviously influenced by Kraftwerk.
Right.
You know, and all that prog stuff that was coming out on Brain in the early 70s, which was all electronic.
Yeah.
Electronic influence, at least, you know, and then all the Perry Kingsley, all the Moog records. They were all, I mean, we could do a whole show on George Moroder that wouldn't even touch past 1975.
Right.
You know what I mean? I mean, the guy, one of the first big Moog records out of the glam movement was him, Son of My Father by Chicory Tip.
Wow.
George Moroder wrote it.
There you go.
And he did their other awesome hit, Cigarettes, Women, and Wine, which, like you, would be the only three vices. That's the course of the song. Cigarettes, Women, and Wine, only three vices of mine. I think those are your vices, aren't they?
They're the bedrock ones.
Yeah. Well, you haven't turned into a doper yet, so it's pretty much Cigarettes, Women, and Wine.
Give me a chance, man.
I know. It'll be heroin.
Yeah, right. Hey, we can't do the show today.
Heroin, Jim Beam, and little kids or something.
How do we
really
get the microphone
out
on the floor?
Yeah. I think actually when you're doing like a lot of the hip hop stuff, it's appropriating it into a new thing, and this goes along with being a pop singer, because when you're making pop music, you're appropriating. Betty LaFette was appropriating funk, soul, or rhythm and blues, jazz. I mean, the Soul Tamarine's got the ragtime rhythm to it. It's the whole beginning of the doon 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 doon. That's like the music for every episode of Hee Haw,
right?
You know what I mean?
It's sitting right next to on the landscape, jug band music.
Exactly.
Like it's right next to it, and it should be the same thing. But here it is. Here's the the great cultural divide that we've had to live through in this culture, in this country. It's just only because of one reason alone: racism. That is it. The only reason it happened that those music did not intermingle sooner is that there was just it wasn't allowed. It just wasn't allowed.
She even mentions that in an interview.
Yeah.
She's like, it was segregation.
Oh, absolutely.
So a lot of people didn't hear this stuff.
Yep.
You thought, you know, people don't know that now. They don't realize that, I guess.
Yeah.
Including me, because I was born later, obviously.
Yeah.
But most people didn't hear R&B that were white at the time. They never heard it.
Yeah, but I just read something about somebody recently, an early rock and roller, and he was like saying how, well, I came to find out that the country stuff, the chord progressions of country music were the same chord progressions of the blues, or the country blues that was happening in the early, like, 20s and 10s.
Right.
And that's, it took, 40 years for that stuff to merge to make rock and roll.
Oh, yeah.
So if people are going to chastise hip hop or disco or all these other things for being, you know,
Do you mean me?
No, you're hip.
Hey, thanks, man.
If people are going to put that shit down and say, "Oh, that's not, you know, you're ripping off something," it's the same thing. Because if you could take a ragtime purist in 1972 that heard Soul Tambourine and go, "What the fuck is going on?" Like this, you know, they're stealing everything from, you know, I can't even think of a rag, Fats Waller. You know what I mean? Like
the Entertainer.
Yeah,
Scott Joplin.
Yeah, Scott Joplin's rolling over in his grave right now.
hearing
this Soul Tambourine nonsense. What is this? You know, pop culture for the kids.
And it's funny to think of something like ragtime. It's beautiful and it's cool and it's intricate, but you don't think of it as swinging. But at its time, that was the most swinging music there was.
Yeah,
by far.
I've had people walk up to me when I've DJed at a club or something or a party.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're like, "Can you play something I can dance to?" I'm playing, you know, The Groover by T-Rex.
Yeah.
I'm like, you can dance to this.
Go.
You know, you're telling me you can't dance to Jumpin' Jack Flash? I mean, go watch any episode of American Bandstand from 1971.
Right.
And, you know, if you're really down, the Hilarious House of Frightenstone.
No, what's that?
It's like a TV show from Toronto from the early 70s.
The Hilarious House of Frightenstone?
Yeah.
Was it a dance show?
No, it was a fucking, Vincent Price was on it. It was a kid's TV show that was, I'm from Buffalo, New York, so I grew up watching this. You never saw it? I mean, you're from Rochester.
We didn't get
Canadian TV over there.
Canadian TV.
Oh, that sucks for you. Well, anyways, every episode had the Wolfman dancing to Jumpin' Jack Flash.
Really?
It was all these. He was like on a green screen with all these psychedelic lights going on behind him and just grooving to Jumpin' Jack. I have it at the
of
cut.
Of course you do.
Oh, you know? Nice.
Anyways, yeah, the Hilarious House of Castle Frightenstein. That's the name of it.
It was a series that came on like every so often, or was it?
It was this guy Billy something. I forget his last name, but it was. I'm sure somebody's going to write in on this one. And go, "Hey, you asshole! It's Billy blah blah blah. Know your shit before you come on the radio talking about it."
Please do write in.
Yeah.
That's
it.
Yeah, I'll know more about that. Definitely.
That's right. And let's take a little break here, and let's turn the clock back. Hit it on track 21.
21. No time to be 21.
Yeah. That's when this is an early 1962. This is their first hit.
All right. Here we go. Did you hear the production on that?
How gorgeous was that?
That's why this girl is fly, because the production on every song that we've played tonight and everything that's on this, you know, CD and everything that I've heard from her, spot on. She worked with good producers.
Mm-hmm.
Just funnily enough, just like what you were saying earlier about Britney Spears.
Yep.
It's a producer. It's a producer's world. And man, the production. I mean, that's 1962. The production is rivaling to Phil Spector as far as being unique.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
And artistically creative.
Close. Yeah, definitely.
You know, it's like, I mean, Phil
has got that sense of place that a lot of those records tried to achieve.
It's deep. There's the strings things going on there that I don't know if you could hear over the computer, but man, if you pick up the CD, and you'll hear it.
And this is still available. This CD, you know, we're talking about Child of the 70s here by Betty LeVette, and this is still available at Rhino Handmade. If you go to rhinohandmade.com, order it. Get it, live it, love it, learn it.
Yeah.
We don't usually do albums that are actually on Rhino, so that's why I just want to take a minute to plug it, because it is worth having. Get it.
You know, it's also funny that she was, you know, my man, he's a loving man. That was like bordering. This is cutting edge at the time because
right.
you know what she's talking about.
Right.
And
why don't you break it down for us?
Yeah.
He's a loving man.
Oh, he brought her flowers?
No.
He took her to dinner?
Yeah.
He took her to dinner?
No, they skipped all that.
Took her to Red Lobster?
He was loving.
Oh.
They just went right to the bedroom and said,
oh.
yeah, we got 60 minute man.
Hey now.
He was Butcher Pete. You know what I'm saying? Chop that meat. Yeah. Anyways, yeah, I mean, so that could have been a route she would have taken.
Sure.
You know, had, like we were saying before, had she had a huge hit with that song,
right.
that could have been the route she would have went. And I think, once again, it was good that she didn't ever get,
for us
yeah. fans, it was good that she never blew the fuck up because she was able to keep progressing through the times because, you know, she could have been stuck doing My Man, He's a Loving Man
right.
for her whole career and be only known as that one song. Instead, we as fans lucked out and we got a girl who covered Free and Neil Young
yep.
and did funky records and worked at Muscle Shoals
yep.
and worked with Ike Turner's studio and
yep.
did all this kick-ass. I mean, she's run the gamut. She was acting in Bubbling Brown Sugar,
yep.
you know, which is the Broadway play.
And she keeps going.
And she's still making records. And now you can actually see her at a little club and go, wow, they don't make them like that anymore.
No, I was reading a testimonial from someone who had just seen her recently, one of the shows she was doing, and she said it basically came out on the stage, sat down cross-legged, this is the first song, on the stage, just sat down and just wailed it out.
Mm-hmm.
Wailed out a whole song like her heart was breaking, like her life depended on it, whole nine yards. And that was the start of the show. And then it was off to the races.
Right.
You know, and it's like, wow. And it's, again, it comes back to being an entertainer. And I think this is something that, unfortunately, as music got bigger and bigger and bigger, and there was more money, and it was more, you know, like it, you know, somewhere along the line, being, and it's right around the time MTV started, too.
81-ish or something?
Yeah, it's like you can make the video, and that performance could play all over the world.
And edit that pause out. That was Mac belching. He didn't want to be doing it in a microphone.
No, we're the most disgusting crew there is. I apologize, fair listeners. Or should I say fair listener? Mom, are you out there? It's one of those things where you just didn't have to. You weren't forced to be an entertainer. And if you weren't forced to be an entertainer, you probably wouldn't be one.
You just rested on people. Most, a lot of people at that point in time, they just rested on that one or
yep.
one big hit or that one gimmick. And that's why not a lot of those people are not around anymore.
Exactly.
Rested on that one. How many early 80s bands? I mean, there's not a lot that are still around that are still.
It's like U2. That's a, you know,
R.E.M.
But even R.E.M. now, and, you know, it's God bless it. I love them, but. They don't have it. They just don't have any relevance anymore.
They don't have drive. That's what I'm
yeah.
saying. Because Letty LeVette never got rich and
she's
she never
drive.
Got famous, so
doing.
She kept her drive.
Mm.
And this is why like Metallica sucks right now. And REM, I'm not saying
I
they suck.
REM until about 1988 when they got signed to the majors, and then that,
yeah.
after that it was just like, oh, we just got $25 million. We're gonna keep putting out the same record.
Yeah,
the agenda changes at that point,
changes, yeah.
and that's.
And I was actually still along for the ride. On that first Warner contract
yeah.
where they did, you know,
Green
and all that
record.
Jazz. And,
yeah.
you know, I love Automatic for the People, and there's a few after that. But then they re-upped again
yeah.
at the end, sort of at the, you know, the end of the 90s,
right.
mid-90s. And that was the time, like, Bill Berry left right afterwards,
yeah.
and that was it. It was, like, really downhill. Then everything just became like, boy, why are you guys
like,
even bothering
I
to put out a record?
Idea when REM, initially, when they said, if one of us leaves, we'll quit.
Yeah.
And I was like, that's great. I hope they
yep.
do that. And they didn't do that.
Of course not.
That was so disappointing to me.
Well, because they owe people $80 million.
Yeah.
I don't think they were expecting
yeah.
to owe anyone $80 million.
Well, that's, you know, the bigger you get, the more responsibilities
yeah.
you have.
Yeah.
You know, and that's, you know, sometimes they're not even, maybe they know it sucks, but they're just going, yeah, we just got to do it, though, because, you know, my drum tech's got a wife and family, and I got to keep him
sure.
in a job.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's true, and I think those are fair rationalizations, and essentially you can rationalize anything.
Right.
But this is what I like about the leveling of the playing field now that we're experiencing in music, where the powerful centers that have, you know, been responsible for music for the last couple decades don't have the hold anymore because they don't own distribution. Distribution is now via the net. Essentially, music is free in a lot of corners. And so if you are an up-and-coming musician or an artist, you have to figure out a way how to earn your own keep. No one's going to sit there and give you the huge advance anymore that you either make or break, you know, this or that. You know, it either ruins you or it makes you. Now,
sorry.
All phones to silence. And so now you just have to sort of eke out your own existence. And there's twofold that's good about that. A, you should keep progressing artistically if you have what it takes. But B, you never have to apologize for a single dollar that you make.
Right.
You own every dollar that you make,
right.
You know, because you've earned it. I just earned it right there. See that sweat sitting out on the stage right there? That's mine.
Right.
That's what I got. Now you give me that money, I give you that sweat. Where it's not like, you know, at the time of the huge deals, you know, something like that REM or the $80 million sort of deal, they went, thank you very much. Even Peter Buck. Peter Buck's a sharp cat. You know, I mean, this is a guy, you want to talk about a music fan. I mean, this guy knows everything.
Yeah,
and he was well aware of the fact that they were on the downward slope of their, you know, huge creative, you know, breakthroughs. And he was like, okay, you know, if you want to give us this money,
yeah,
go ahead. But I'm going to tell you, I don't think we're going to be getting any more huge records out of us. And he was exactly right, you know.
Yeah. Hopefully it levels the playing field to the point that everything stops. Because,
mm-hmm,
I mean, you know, like you were saying before, you listen to your Epitaph compilation, your like Motion City soundtrack, whatever.
Yep.
It's kind of cookie cutter, emo, whatever you want to call it. And Epitaph certainly stopped putting out groundbreaking records. I mean, they kind of did The Offspring and Rancid and said,
right,
okay, we've made our, that's, you know, I mean,
we've legitimized what we started with.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. It's like having a baby. It's like, you know, you go, you know what? I had my kid. I was 25. I had my kid. You know, I'm 45 right now. I did it. You know, I moved on. I did my one thing. And people are lucky to have their one thing.
Right.
Like, they don't even realize it. But Epitaph, I mean, there's a million labels. Alternative Tentacles would have killed to have a record as big as The Offspring or Rancid.
Yeah.
Or any, you know, Touch and Go or SST.
Mm-hmm.
Like, none of those labels had a record that sold nothing close to what Offspring and Rancid records. So luckily the guys, you know, at Epitaph went, okay, we'll start Anti. And then they went and go and sign, you know, the good guys, Nick Cave,
yeah,
and, you know,
Tom Waits,
Elliot Smith,
yeah,
Betty LeVette. It's for,
yeah,
an
Betty
artist.
LeVette's got two records out on Anti now, recorded in 2005 and 2007.
Right.
You know, I mean, this is a viable new artist.
Exactly.
Which is amazing, huh?
And so, but the thing is, you know, you gotta, it's a lot of it is because of bands like Epitaph. You gotta have the nonsense that,
right,
that everybody likes in order to have, well, at least we can get the good shit. And so, but I think right now in music, there's just so much crap out there, and there's so many people. No one is taking chances, and no one is pushing the envelope, and no one wants to be a fucking pop star in a genre of music, because you could do that as well.
Right.
You want to be a punk rock pop star, you know. I don't see the singer from AFI as a punk rock pop star.
Right.
I don't see the singer from, what's the guy that wears makeup? Well, Green Day's a whole different thing. Plus, they're too old. They're already like 40, so.
Right.
You can't, I'm talking about bands where the members are under 30.
My Chemical Romance
is the band I was talking about. Like, I don't see these guys trying to push the envelope. Like you said earlier, Bowie pushed the envelope. He was always pushing the envelope. Glam rock was dead, according to Dave Bowie, in 1973. Glam rock had barely arrived to the general consensus in 73, and Bowie had already declared it dead. Or Bolan. Maybe Bolan declared it dead first.
I think Bolan was still hoping it was alive because it had been stolen out from under him. He's like, yeah, I hope this keeps going for a little longer so I can cash in.
Yeah, that's true.
In America. Sorry, I don't mean to get controversial.
Well, it never did hit America, unfortunately. I don't think glam ever hit America. There was not
really
one hit.
Well, Bang a Gong was a hit over here, but that was about it.
I remember hearing Sweet when I was really little on like Top 40 radio. Definitely.
Maybe Fox on the Run. But, I mean, come on.
Fox on the Run, Little Willie, there's a few of them. There was not
Fox on the Run's the only one I remember. From the 70s.
Little Willie, I have a 45 of. So when I was like 6 or 7, that was popular.
Yeah, but that was bubblegum, so that's a little bit different. It's
still
not glam.
Still sweet, though.
I know it's still a sweet,
and
but
if you don't
Willie,
like the sweet, there's the door.
Yeah, there's the door.
That's whatever for you, Vin.
Yeah. I wonder if the Eagles are popular in Europe.
I don't think so.
They're,
you know,
huge here. They just,
they're huge here.
Right.
They just signed a deal with Walmart or something.
Yeah, they just sold 700,000 records.
Yeah.
which I still debate that figure. You really sell 700?
I don't even think they sold 700,000.
Well, that was the number.
Sold out like six. What was it? Six nights at the Staples Center or something?
They did.
Usually popular still.
No, they are. Well, I mean, you're talking about a band that has the highest selling record of all time. Their Greatest Hits, Volume One, has sold more than anything. Period.
More than Thriller.
Yeah, more than Thriller.
Wow.
It's the number one, numero uno.
Number one. But I don't think they translate to Europe. I don't.
No.
No, that's strictly an American thing.
Because, and they're too apple pie. I mean, there are things that are very American that do translate to Europe that America doesn't get. You know, Graham Parsons is revered in, you know, I would think in Europe a little bit more than here.
That's revered in Europe. More
Betty LaVette, absolutely. That she was only...
All black music from pre-1970s revered in Europe.
Absolutely.
James Brown would play in, London. That was front page news, man. The Godfathers play in our town, you know?
Well, I was watching a Stax documentary the other day that just came out recently, which is very good. I highly recommend picking it up. It's a story of Stax Records, and, you know, they got all the great performances on it. But you basically hear these guys, you know, talking about how they were playing. It's kind of like the Ramones. It's funny. It's like, it's very similar to punk rock, where these guys were playing little, tiny clubs in America, one-nighters, busting their asses, putting out records, making enough money to keep going, but that's about it. You know, keep the record company alive and everything. Go to Europe, concert halls. Front-page news. Treated like stars. Same thing when the Ramones would go to South America. They would play for hundreds of thousands of people. The Ramones.
Right.
You know, which now it's easy to say, you know, like, oh, the Ramones, everybody knows the Ramones because it's been, you know, decades hence. But the Ramones, nobody liked the Ramones. Nobody. You could find like 1 in 10 people who liked the Ramones.
I think a lot of people liked the Ramones. I think the Ramones were an anomaly. They were the one band that, like, They were the pop stars of that thing. Like, if a guy was a football team player, you know, and he was like the one punk band he liked would be the Ramones, which REM kind of replaced the Ramones in the 80s.
Right.
You know, but in the 70s through to like the late 80s that I was in school, the Ramones was like the one band that was accessible and people knew who they were. But the thing about the Ramones is they were so across the board that there was like nobody, a lot of people took them for granted. You know what I mean?
Well, and it's also, you know, there was also sort of the Muso contingent who would sit there and listen to it, and someone who considered themselves hip to, oh, you know, I get music, and I've listened to a lot of bands over the years, and you know what, I expect my band to go from, you know, playing roots music to psychedelic and three records. And it was like the most common argument I would hear hurled against them from guys who grew up on, you know, like the Doobie Brothers would be like, man, it's the same fucking song.
Right.
I'm sorry, you put out 10 records of the same song. That doesn't impress me, you know, and it's like, okay, well, you're obviously not really listening, you know.
Yeah.
Well, the other thing is, too, you didn't hear a lot of the Ramones, actually, they didn't play any Ramones.
No.
No, but what I'm saying is that it was like the Ramones, to me, I'm 38 years old, was an institution. You know, it was always there. Like we didn't take it for granted, but, I mean, I saw the Ramones, like, probably at least five times.
But you're also from New York, too.
That doesn't really mean
I mean,
that.
They got around everywhere, don't get me wrong, but I'm saying...
They really played... I mean, they played every 6 months where we're from. Definitely.
Yeah. I mean, that same thing Marty says. He's probably seen like 13 Ramones shows or something.
Yeah, probably all the ones he was at, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Too. And it's like Rush. Like, Rush played upstate New York 10,000 times. How many times have they played here? Probably not nearly, obviously.
No. Okay, all right, that's true. But I still see that. I mean, they made a movie about the Ramones in 1978, so they had to be something important going on with this band.
Well, you know why? Because they had connections in... You know, Hollywood liked them to some degree. Like, they were a darling to some extent. You know, if you got Phil Spector wanting to make a record with you, and this is, you know, this is back when still, I mean, Johnny Ramone was the guy going out of bounds saying, like, hey, Phil Spector, you had a couple good records in the 60s. What have you done lately? Big deal. You know, no one else would say that in a million years. Like, everyone was like, no, Phil Spector, you know. So to have Phil Spector do that, suddenly everyone's going to look at it and go, oh, and these guys are an easily cartoonable band. They have that uniform look.
Right.
They're the type of band who's like, we can make a movie about this.
Yeah, Rockin' High School is essentially a cartoon.
Right. You know? And you can't, but you're not going to make a movie about Blue Oyster Cult because who are those guys?
Right.
You know, who the fuck is Blue? You know, like, I don't know who any of those guys are, but I know who Tony, Johnny, Joey, Tommy, and Dee Dee are.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, I've never seen a member of... a member of Blue Oyster Cult walked up on the street, I wouldn't know who they were.
No shit. Yeah, no, absolutely.
A Ramon, you'd know, like, bam, that's a Ramon. You know, that'll be it.
Yeah, but I think that they were a lot more popular in the consensus. They weren't financially popular because I think a Ramones concert was something you just kind of went to. You know, it's like everybody saw the Ramones, but it's just like maybe because they were so consistently similar.
So new compared, and what they were doing was so different from what 1975 was.
And it was a complete affront to musicianship. And you got to remember, by the time 1975 rolled around, musicianship was key. Nobody knew who the Stooges were. You know, like nobody knew that you couldn't.
People say that all the time, but I disagree because even on the friggin' Ramones DVD, Marky Ramone's going, when he's explaining his 32nd note right hand on the hi-hats, it is very impressive. He's like, a lot of drummers can do this, but very few drummers can do this.
Right.
And he tells you, and I tell you, I know one drummer that can play like that.
Yeah, but it's deceptive. What I'm trying to say is somebody who considers himself to appreciate musicianship is not going to get the intricacies. Anyone who actually knows it, this is what I'm saying. I'm talking about popular perception.
Oh,
I'm talking
about
cats standing around the record store that guy really knows how to play, you know, who've never picked up a guitar in their life.
Or didn't at the time, too. Yeah, I mean, the people that were considered themselves...
Sorry, I can lean back.
People that were like into musicianship at the time didn't consider that.
No, I know, but the funny thing about it is,
and most of the people would look at that and go, no, that guy's an idiot. He's not. That's not true. Until they actually sat down on a drum set and tried to do it.
Exactly.
You know.
Exactly.
It's like that episode of The Monkees where, you know, it's like Davy Jones is sitting down there with one of his collaborators on the piano, playing a song. It's sort of like away from the actual episode, and this guy's actually explaining. To him, as a soul musician, the guy who he's talking to is saying, well, here's where the soul is in the Beatles. It's on the, you know, we do 2 and 4, you know, in R&B and soul music. You know, Ringo's on the 1 and the 3, you know. And he's like, it's the same, you know, it's like, it's just as soulful. It's just 2 different beats.
Right.
You know, and it's like, it takes someone who's so far inside the music to actually realize that and not just go, oh, he doesn't do 1 million fills and he doesn't do this and that and he's not a flashy drummer. To realize, no, he's one of the most important drummers, you know, who's ever come along, just in terms of popular music. You can't deny it.
It's just weird the different perspectives that you look at when you're analyzing these kind of things.
And this is our show, ladies and gentlemen. And we're going to actually, we want to, because we've been John for a while now here, and I've enjoyed the hell out of it. But I want to play one more song. We're going to actually wrap up this episode on Miss Betty LeVette. I want to do track 6, All the Black and White Children. Let's end it with some social conscience. Hold on a second, so I'll take us out here for a minute. I want to thank you, Chris, for coming back and do this again, and we'll do this again soon. Michelle, thank you so much for coming in.
It was awesome.
And you know what's great is? You talk so much more than the Lord. He's going to be jealous.
Yeah, the Lord will be envious.
And I want to thank everyone for listening who's listening out there. And please, give us a buzz. You know, go to rhino.com. We got the RhinoCast page. You know, leave a comment or email us or do anything, you know. Just let us know you're listening out there. And if not, enjoy what we're doing. Pick up some of these records we're talking about. And, you know,
all of the black and white children, all of the black and white children, innocence and purity.
You've just listened to a Rhino.com podcast. Visit Rhino.com for music, movies, and all kinds of crazy shit.